From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Bombings of U.S. embassies in both Kenya and Tanzania. We'll also go down to Colombia, where a major guerrilla offensive is taking place, and it's the 100th anniversary of the annexation of Hawaii. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Terrorist bombs exploded minutes apart outside the U.S. embassies in the Kenyan and Tanzanian capitals today, toppling a four-story building and killing more than 50 people. Hundreds more were injured. Americans were among the dead, and the U.S. ambassador to Kenya was injured, the State Department says. More than 40 were killed, 1,000 wounded in Nairobi alone. This according to a Red Cross spokesperson. Witnesses said at least 9 were killed and 16 hurt in Tanzania. It was definitely a bomb, said a U.S. embassy official in Nairobi, who refused to give his name. It said, you can see a huge crater behind the building, and a bomb went off at the embassy in Tanzania at the same time. The State Department called the blasts, which occurred 5 minutes apart, terrorist attacks. The blast in the Kenyan capital occurred at 3:35 in the morning Eastern Standard Time. It toppled the four-story Yafundi Cooperative Building toward the embassy, which was badly damaged. Cooperative Bank House with government and private offices also was damaged. In Nairobi, crowds crawled over a mountain of twisted and broken concrete and metal looking for victims, calling out and waving their arms for help to free trapped people. Bodies were draped out of windows in a charred bus. Shattered cars were left smoldering on the street amid the debris. Dazed and bloody survivors lay on the ground until they were led away. A Red Cross spokesperson said, once the rubble is cleared further, we expect to find more. Another Red Cross worker who refused to give his name said there are too many dead to count. In the Tanzanian capital of Dar es Salaam, a suspected car bomb exploded in the U.S. Embassy parking lot. At least 9 people were killed and 16 injured. Official confirmation was not immediately available. Smoke rose from the damaged buildings. Nearly 2/3 of the embassy was destroyed. This according to witnesses. Cranes were hurried to the site to tear apart wreckage in the search for survivors. U.S. officials refused to speculate on who is responsible. President Clinton was woken up and briefed on the situation at 5:30 Eastern Standard Time. Administration officials said on condition of anonymity, he's watching it very closely. Obviously, at this point, the reaction is shock. He said, we're trying to get more information. Security was immediately tightened at other U.S. embassies, including Kampala, Uganda, where vehicles were cleared away. Again, this top story, and that is that at least 40 people have been killed. It is speculated more than 1,000 people have been wounded at 2 U.S. embassies and their surroundings in both the Tanzanian capital, Dar es Salaam, and the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, that being today's top story. Meanwhile, this news going on around the Democratic Republic of the Congo. South Africa sent a team of ministers to the Congo today for talks with embattled President Laurent Kabila on ways of containing the spreading revolt in the former Zaire. But the commander of the rebels in a telephone interview from Goma is in the east of Africa's third largest nation, ruled out any political settlement with Kabila and said that rebel forces were advancing on several fronts. This news from Colombia, which is in the middle of a huge rebel offensive in the run-up of the country's presidential inauguration today. The government said 71 soldiers and police were killed and 85 wounded by rebels of the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or FARC, and the National Liberation Army, or ELN. Another 100 security force members were missing, and 198 rebels had been killed, this according to the government. A FARC spokesperson gave sharply different figures in a radio interview yesterday. He said rebels killed at least 143 soldiers and police and took 133 as prisoners, and that only 15 guerrillas died. The onslaught was a rude welcome for Andres Pastrana, who was to be sworn in as president today and will be going to Colombia in just a few minutes. Tension between Burma's military junta and the opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi mounted today ahead of the 10-year anniversary of the bloody crackdown on pro-democracy activists. Witnesses said the number of government security guards at Suu Kyi's lakeside home in Rangoon was doubled to about 15 today, a day after the daughter of Burma's late national hero and founding father Aung San had demanded the military leave the compound. Again, today's top story, two looks-like bombings at the capitals in Kenya and Tanzania. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, joined by my co-host, Juan Gonzalez. Welcome, Juan.
Good day, Amy. And obviously, these bombings at these two U.S. embassies and all these people killed sort of put into more realistic context, the madness going on in Washington over Monica Lewinsky, that serious issues all around the world obviously are going untouched or unreported because of this feeding frenzy on the Lewinsky case.
That's right. I never thought I would see that story blown out of the headlines as it was this morning when I woke up. Again, this happening about 3:30 Eastern Standard Time, just a few hours before this broadcast. This latest news of what clearly looks like bombs, because they happened about 10 minutes apart in both the capitals of Tanzania and Kenya, right next to and seriously damaging both U.S. embassies in both countries, looking like more than 1,000 people have been wounded. At least 40 people have been killed at this point. So that's the latest news that we have. We don't want to speculate and feed into that, though it seems it's all the media does these days, whether it's a domestic case like the president's crises at home or situations like this. We're always in the most difficult situation now because people throw out different ideas, and each of those can be damaging in themselves.
And, you know, I read recently where there not a single U.S. network has a regular crew of reporters stationed in Africa. So I'm sure that it's going to be a while. They're going to be borrowing basically what they can get from local televisions there or from some of the European stations. But that shows you the lack of interest or importance that the networks place, and none of them have any regular correspondents stationed in Africa.
That's right. I believe after 1994, when Nelson Mandela was elected president in South Africa, many of the networks simply pulled out their crews. Well, we will continue to bring our listeners updated information throughout the show if we learn more facts about what has happened in these two Eastern African countries, Tanzania and Kenya, where the U.S. embassies have been seriously damaged, and the people, we don't know how many Kenyan, how many Tanzanian, how many American, how many others have been killed and wounded. Again, estimates at least 40 dead, at least 1,000 wounded. Well, right now we're, though, going to go down to Bogota, Colombia, which, as I said earlier, is in the middle of a huge rebel offensive in the run-up to today's presidential inauguration. We go down to Bogota, where we're joined by Mario Murillo. Mario is the producer of a national weekly radio program called Our Americas. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Mario.
Thank you, Amy, and hi, Juan. How are you guys doing?
Fine, Mario.
Well, tell us what's happening today in Bogota and in what context it's taking place.
Well, today is almost a sideshow. Today, actually, August 7th, marks the 179th anniversary of the Battle of Boyacá, which happens to be the most decisive battle in the Colombian War for Independence 180 years ago. And it's only fitting that today it's also the inauguration of Conservative Party leader Andrés Pastrana, who is the 87th president in Colombia, and he's also ending the reign of the Liberal Party after 12 years of Liberal Party rule here. The Conservative Party, which I guess we can say is the equivalent of the Republican Party in the United States in terms of the political spectrum here in Colombia, is finally taking reins of power, and with a lot of expectations that he's going to be able to turn around the country. But the fact is that, I said, the inauguration is nothing but a sideshow compared to what happened earlier in the week and which people are still talking about. And that is the massive rebel offensive, which you referred to, Amy, in your introduction. A rebel offensive that took place in about 14 different departments throughout the country. It was a joint rebel offensive coordinated by the FARC, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, the largest rebel group here in Colombia, as well as the National Liberation Army, the ELN, the second largest rebel group here in Colombia. In that offensive, at least 69 soldiers were killed. Dozens were injured throughout the country. Over 100 soldiers were detained and captured by the FARC. The most visible example was took place in the anti-narcotics base in Miraflores, which is a town in the southeastern part of Colombia, the main coca-growing region in the country, where about 60% of the coca is grown in Colombia. And in that offensive, in that attack, 100 soldiers were captured by the FARC. The base was completely leveled. 1,000 guerrillas came in from all sides with rockets, with grenade launchers, and basically took the base by surprise. And they killed 30 of the soldiers, and it was one of the major attacks in the history of this 40-year civil war. And some people saw it as a way to despedir or say goodbye to the outgoing president, Ernesto Samper, but others see it as a more clear example of an escalation of the war as the country just begins to kickstart a peace process that's just beginning to get underway with the new president.
Well, Mario, the events, it seemed to me that they're unusual in two ways, and maybe you could tell our listeners a little bit about that. It seems, one, unusual that this of course is the longest running civil war in all of Latin America, and probably the most underreported in terms of its impact on a nation. But the cooperation between the FARC and the ELN is unusual, isn't it? In that they've generally speaking have not had that much cooperation in the past, as I understand it. And also the reality that even though you have a conservative president now assuming power in Pastrana, for the first time there are real talks with that include the FARC and the other guerrilla group in terms of a possible peace process that, of course, did not occur in the previous liberal administrations. Could you talk about a little bit about that?
Yeah, briefly, in terms of the cooperation in the early 90s, there had been joint military operations, but not at this scale. In the early 90s, when the government of Cesar Gaviria, who is now the head of the OAS, when he tried to carry out negotiations, it was under a banner called the Coordinadora Guerrillera, and that was basically the umbrella organization of all the guerrilla groups. So that was pretty much the first time in which they were being represented as an umbrella organization. But for the most part, you're right, the two military guerrilla organizations have operated independently, but I think both the FARC and the ELN were really responding to a number of developments which took place earlier, a couple of weeks ago, and I get it's something that's pretty alarming here in Colombia. Last night I was talking to a couple of people who were very close to a series of negotiations that took place, coordinated by the National Council for Peace, which is an institution mandated by the Colombian Congress under the Samper administration to basically lay out the framework for a peace negotiation. They're not an actual negotiating body, but they're basically laying out the framework and trying to establish a framework for a negotiation. They met with the paramilitary organization, the United Self-Defense Organization of Colombia, which is the other factor of violence here in this country right now. And they had talked to the leader of the paramilitary organizations, Carlos Castaño, and he had said that although they were going to sign an accord or a proclamation about defending and protecting international human rights law and about trying to establish a framework for discussions between the government and the paramilitaries, he also clearly stated in those discussions that as a military organization, we're going to carry out a series of planned massacres, which we already had laid out as part of our strategy. So regardless of whether or not we're going to sign this proclamation for humanitarian law, we're going to carry out these military activities. Apparently that word got leaked to the FARC and to the guerrillas in general, and that's when they carried out this offensive, sort of as a preliminary attack or trying to offset that attack. And I think that was the response that the two guerrilla groups were really anticipating. That's what they wanted to do, is basically to offset that. The only problem is that, obviously, when there's an offensive of this nature by the guerrillas, it always comes with major reprisals on the part of the paramilitaries and the public and the Colombian armed forces, which is obviously going to have a devastating impact on the civilian population. Now, in terms of what you asked regarding the conservative president, I guess we can call this sort of like the Nixonian approach to China. Everybody said that if anybody's going to reach an accord or lead to a peace negotiation with the rebels, it's a conservative it's a right-wing government that has close links with the military and that has been traditionally the most hawk-like actors in the Colombian political landscape. And I think that's where what we're seeing right now is that the people saw that the Liberal Party basically had no political agenda, no peace agenda, and that they've failed in all respects to try to carry out a peace negotiation, and that now that it's time to give a chance to the conservative president. But he has a lot yet to crack. He has to really tone down the rhetoric coming out of the military high command, which says that they still think that it's not a good time to negotiate. He also has to make clear the positions around the paramilitaries, because on the one hand, they say that they're going to clamp down on the paramilitaries and arrest its leaders, but on the other hand, they're okaying these kind of negotiations between the National Council of Peace and the paramilitaries and basically giving them a legitimate political platform. And he also has to tone down the attacks against, or at least the rhetoric against, the guerrillas. Everybody's saying that this is a massive human rights violation that the guerrillas just carried out. They're all painting it as a massive abuse of a peace process when there is no real peace process going on. And that the fact of the matter is that the guerrilla offensive targeted military targets. It was part of the ongoing war. It was a battle that was directly targeting military installations throughout the country, unlike the paramilitary attacks, which usually are targeted against the civilian population.
Well, Mario Murillo, we want to thank you very much for joining us today on this inauguration of the new president of Colombia, and also during this major rebel offensive that is taking place in Colombia. Mario Murillo, who is the producer and host of the national weekly radio program Our America, is joining us from Bogota, Colombia. And you are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Next Wednesday marks 100 years since the United States annexed Hawaii, an annexation that many native Hawaiians say was illegal. This weekend, thousands of Hawaiians and their political allies are descending on the U.S. Capitol to begin the Aloha March, a demonstration marking the 100th anniversary of the annexation of the islands and illuminating the continued plight of Native Americans in securing lands which are rightfully theirs. The march begins with a 24-hour prayer vigil and concludes at the Ellipse, the commons area adjacent to the White House, where numerous speakers will be discussing the burgeoning Hawaiian rights movement and injustices to Native Hawaiians since the island nation's monarchy was overthrown in 1893. While Native Hawaiians have struggled for decades to retain land and political rights once held by their ancestors, the sovereignty movement gained momentum and national attention in 1993 when President Clinton signed the Apology Bill, addressed to Native Hawaiians acknowledging the unlawful federal seizure of Hawaii in 1893. Native Hawaiians are the poorest population in the state and hold just 17.5% of its acreage. Hawaiians from Hawaii and the continental U.S. are expected to join the Aloha March, together with supporters from other Polynesian nations, Native American nations throughout the U.S., and global indigenous peoples' rights groups. Among the islands and around the world, there's newfound consensus on the need to right the wrongs suffered by Native Hawaiians. And we're joined right now by two people who have come to Washington for the march. Punani Rogers is with us, born and raised on the island of Kauai, a longtime Hawaiian sovereignty activist. She's been with the Aloha March since the beginning. And we're joined by Al Kuahi, who was born and raised in Honolulu, currently an environmental protection specialist with the federal USPA. He is president of the Boston Hawaiian Club and principal organizer of the Aloha March, both joining us in our Washington studio. Well, welcome to Democracy Now! And Punani Rogers, you have traveled a long way to come to Washington, D.C. Tell us about why you've come here. Puanani Rogers, we're going to break for stations to identify themselves, but then we'll be back with you and Kyle and Al Kuahi, both here for the Aloha March. It's taking place in the nation's capital in Washington, D.C. There will also be marches on the Hawaiian Islands. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, and after we speak with them, we'll be joined by world-renowned reggae artist and dub poet Linton Kwesi Johnson. Stay with us.
Here's another song also I learned. This song is called Eliliu'i.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Juan, I just want to update people on the situation that we have has just been breaking as we go. This is the situation in Africa, although we're just about to talk about the situation in Hawaii. I want to give people the latest news. At this point, it looks like news has it that there are 80 people dead at the two capitals. Again, huge explosions rock the U.S. embassies both in Kenya and Tanzania. At least 80 people dead, some 1,000 people injured. Two people reported to have been killed in the Dar es Salaam blast. The latest news that we have from the Reuters wire, U.S. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright is returning to Washington from a private visit to Italy following explosions at embassies in Nairobi and Dar es Salaam. Albright had flown to Rome overnight to attend the wedding of her spokesperson, James Rubin. It says she's on her way back now, a State Department official. And again, these explosions that took place just hours ago at the two capitals took place just 10 minutes apart. And the U.S. Embassy, or at least the U.S. State Department, is definitely calling them terrorist bomb attacks. Well, we are going to switch gears a little bit right now because we understand that we've had trouble making contact with our guests in Washington. While we were able to hear them, they were not going out over the satellite. So we're going to switch gears. We're going to take a music break, and in just a minute, we're going to be joined by Linton Kwesi Johnson. But on the issue of Hawaii, we will certainly continue to pursue that issue. If not today, then on another show. But I think we'll be able to get them by the end of the show. Again, right now, we will turn to the world renowned reggae artist and dub poet, Linton Kwesi Johnson.
Wait a moment, wait a little put on you. Thinking Jeff have to be struggling hard. And we now go figure to do recognition. We did want nothing more than that. Equal right for y'all with you. White are you black? So we now go worry, now worry no longer. Every poor parents they did.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, again, trying to deal with a lot of things as they break in Colombia with the rebel offensive, in Africa and Tanzania and Kenya with the latest news of the explosions at the U.S. embassies there, and trying to keep our satellite uplink going. Well, it does look like we've reconnected, so in a few minutes we'll be joined by Linton Kwesi Johnson, but we wanted to bring you this conversation with Puanani Rogers and Al Kauahi, both Hawaiians. Puanani Rogers, born and raised on the island of Kauai. Al Kauahi, who is born in Honolulu but is now in Boston and currently heads up the Boston Hawaiian Club. Puanani Rogers, you've come to Washington, D.C. for the Aloha March. And if you could reiterate what the demands of the march are.
Thank you very much. Aloha to all out there that can hear my voice. I bring you the aloha from our beautiful islands of Hawaii. The question was, what brings me here to Washington, D.C.? Well, it is a vision and a dream that happened about 5 years ago. And so I feel I'm here to fulfill a vision and a dream. And it was one that was started by one of my heroes. His name is John Butch Kekahu, and his family that started this vision to come to Washington, D.C. on the 100th anniversary of the annexation or supposed purported annexation of our islands.
Let's bring I wanted to bring Al Kauahi into the discussion now in Boston, but down in Washington for the Aloha March. Here you are, a native Hawaiian who lives on the mainland. Why did you move? It doesn't sound like it's unusual for native Hawaiians to leave Hawaii.
Kalamai, sorry about that. Aloha, everyone. First of all, my name is Al Kauahi Wong. So Wong is my last name. And I moved away from Hawaii, like I think about 30% of people from Hawaii presently. We move away because of economics, because we're unable to sustain ourselves and have a decent living, especially for those of us who are Hawaiians and are impacted as an example of food. So at some point I'd like to comment on water issues. But basically I live in Boston because, as many others, because it's difficult for us to live where we want to.
On the issue of water, that actually is a major issue. People might not think that when you live in an island surrounded by water, but this issue of water is an invaluable resource and the symbol of development on Hawaii and what that means to Native Hawaiians.
That's right.
Very true. Water is the source that provides all. Without water, there is nothing. Water is needed to grow taro, which makes poi, the staple of our people. Water is needed, obviously, for all the other things.
And poi, and so being on. A kind of sweet potato?
You could liken it to sweet potato. It's not really sweet in taste. It's rather bland, which is kind of like those who eat rice, which is bland to offset other taste and flavors. Very delicious. But on water, I work for the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. I'm an environmental protection specialist. I specialize in drinking water. And because of that, I certainly have an interest in environmental concerns, not only in Hawaii, but elsewhere. And water in Hawaii, I'm going to give an example, the Waioli Ditch. Many years ago, at the turn of the century, water was diverted for the Americans who owned the sugarcane and pineapple fields. By taking this water for that purpose, they took a lot of water, which caused considerable damage to where the water was from, or one part of the island. And that continues today. Right now, those interests have decided that it's not profitable for agriculture in this sense, and certainly it makes sense to give the water back. The water is needed to grow taro and all these other things, as well as the o'opu and all the other things in the streams. They did not want to give the water back. So what they do, they say that they wanted to keep the water for other farming purposes on the dry side, on the island of Oahu. But they're not serious about this. They want to keep the water right because they have some other ideas about that water. If they were serious about the water, they would give those farmers their long-term leases. They do not. Now, for a short time, some of this water went back. The water went back, and when that went back, it was most remarkable to see how nature, how nature healed itself, how the water went back, the streams gave birth again, the o'upu came back, the opai came back, which is shrimp, and everything came back slowly, but nature resolved itself. So it's necessary. How this impacts lack of water is terrible. Right now, as I said, the staple of a Hawaiian food, of Hawaiian people, is poi. Poi costs anywhere from $4 up a pound. Look at the cost of rice. 1 pound of poi, no problem, I can eat 1 pound poi. But at $4 a pound, rice and potatoes, those other things are reasonable. Poi is not. So what's happening, because we do not have water for poi and for these purposes, we cannot eat this traditional food.
So the water is going to these massive developments, hotels, fake lagoons that are being built around the
this
island?
This is true. For
golf
those
courses?
Golf
and
courses.
All these kind of things. And so for tourists or visitors to our islands who go to these fancy hotels with these water cascades and these little canals, I mean, what a waste of water. I don't care if they say we recirculate the water. We're not using that much. Mm-hmm. That is not right. That is not right. Well, we need the water for poi.
I'd like to ask Punani Rogers, as a Puerto Rican, I'm very familiar with this whole issue of relationship of U.S. Possession islands to the United States. Most Americans regard the Hawaii situation, they know very little about the history, and their viewpoint is, well, the Hawaiians voted for, became a state in 1959, and why are people now, 30, 40 years later, why has a new sovereignty movement developed, and where is the thrust of the direction of this sovereignty movement? Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, thank you very much. The Hawaiians were duped. We did not vote for, there are many that did not vote for statehood. We did not feel that it was a justifiable question. They gave us no choice. We feel that we should have been asked whether we wanted to be independent, free association, other than just asking us if we wanted to be a state. The options were not given to us. And there were many that cried when we found out that we became a state of the United States of America.
Danny, I want to add also that 98% of all Hawaiians voted against statehood.
What percentage?
98%.
And so the margin then, because the referendum won by a considerable amount, came from what sectors of those who resided in Hawaii? The margin of the vote for statehood.
It came from the non-native
Hawaiians?
Came from
the businessmen, yes, from the plantation businesses, people that owned businesses in Hawaii.
But and there were also
big business.
You know, it was big businesses that did this. The descendants of the missionaries who came to teach the Hawaiians, the descendants are now the Big Five. All right, the Big Five, big interests. Mm-hmm. All right, this is all politics as its purest. Its purest, we did not want this. The Big Five wanted this, and they used all their powers.
And the Big Five
it's
were
money.
The Big Five.
The
Castle
Big Five.
And Cook, Alexander and Baldwin, American Factors, Dillingham, to name a few.
Mm-hmm. And going back, since this is the 100th anniversary of the annexation, in fact, the U.S. Senate was not able to get a two-thirds vote to annex Hawaii. Isn't that right? So they went to a kind of joint resolution where they didn't have to get the two-thirds vote. And it was that is now being raised as the question of legality of even annexing Hawaii to begin with 100 years ago.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Illegal. Illegal.
So what do you want today? What kind of status for Hawaii do you want today?
First, we need to bring out the truth. We're here to speak the truth and let everyone know, especially people that live here on the continent, please, we come here to give you a history lesson, and we welcome you to join us at the Ellipse on Saturday afternoon. We will have music, entertainment, and speeches, and question and answers, but more or less our sharing of our love and our mana'o, our thoughts.
And in terms of the large populations, non-Hawaiian populations on the island, for instance, there's a significant, I know, population of Japanese-descended, Chinese-descended. There are even several thousand Puerto Ricans who were brought there as sugarcane cutters in the early 1900s. I know I once visited and found Puerto Rican bars and neighborhoods in Hawaii. The Filipinos and the others. What's the relationship between the development of the native sovereignty, the sovereignty movement among the native Hawaiians and these various other populations?
I'd like to answer that. This is Punani. They all support us. We have many of them supporting us, especially because we know the history of the Puerto Ricans. They, too, were annexed in the same year by a treaty, by the Paris Treaty. Incidentally, on July 25th, there was a group of Puerto Ricans that came to Washington, D.C. as well to march. Isn't that true?
Yes, you mean from Hawaii?
No, from all over the world.
Oh, yes. No, there was a march on July 25th, yes. But I do know that even some Puerto Ricans from Hawaii came to that march, yes.
Yes.
So right. These marches, there's one march that's taking place in Washington, D.C., and then there are marches taking place in various Hawaiian islands as well, leading up to next week's anniversary. I guess it's Wednesday, August 12th, 1998, 100 years since the annexation.
Yes, and I would like to add one more. There is a group of our people in Fairbanks, Alaska, that also will be having a march on Saturday at the same time.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for joining us, for stopping by at the Washington studio, Pacifica Station WPFW, on your way to the march in Washington, D.C. If people want to call and find out more about the whole Hawaiian movement, Native Hawaiian movement, where can they call?
I think it would be probably best if those who have an interest in finding out about more of the issues is to go to the Boston Hawaiian Club's webpage, where we have something on that, as well as a link not only to the Kauai Foundation, the Aloha March's webpage, but other appropriate links. And the address is www.bostonhawaiianclub.org.
That's www.bostonhawaiianclub.org. Well, I want to thank you both very much for joining us. Puanani Rogers, au kuahi.
Mahalo.
Mahalo.
Thank you.
Our headquarters is at the St. James Hotel in Washington, D.C., by the way.
Thank you for that.
And thank you for being with us.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Next up, Lyndon Kwesi Johnson.
We're marching out the old towards the new century, armed with the new technology. We're getting more and more productivity. Some say things looking up for prosperity. But if everyone gon' get a share this time, well, mentality must get left behind. We want the shorter working day, give it the shorter working week. Longer holiday, we need peace and fear. More time for leisure, more time for pleasure, more time for edification, more time for recreation, more time for contemplate, more time for ruminate, more time. We need more time, do we more time? A full time them abolish unemployment and revolutionize labor deployment. A full time them banish overtime, make everybody get a work this time. We need a higher quality of liberty. We need it now and for everybody. We need the shorter working year. Give it the shorter working life. More time for the husband. More time for the wife. More time for the children. More time for a friend. And more time for meditate. More time for praying. More time for living. More time for life. More time. We need more time. Do we more time?
Linton Kwesi Johnson, his piece More Time, and we'll be back with more of him in just a minute after stations identify themselves. Stay with us. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez, our guest, Linton Kwesi Johnson, world-acclaimed reggae artist and dub poet, here to talk about his politics and his music. He says he coined the phrase dub poetry to argue that what DJs in Jamaica actually did was poetry, improvised, spontaneous, oral poetry. He was born in rural Jamaica, moved to England, became a member of the Black Panthers in 1970, where he began writing poetry and reciting it publicly. And, well, I don't have to tell you so much about him because it's much more interesting to hear him talk. Linton Kwesi Johnson, welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
Well, it's been really thrilling to be going through your latest CDs and to just hear your work over the years. Tell us a little more about yourself. You were born where in Jamaica?
I was born in Clarendon, rural Jamaica. My parents came from a peasant family background, rural farmers. My grandfather was a carpenter and a farmer. My mother went to live in England in the early 60s, and I was brought over there as a child, age 11. Grew up in London, went to school there and all of that, and became politicized during the late 60s, early 70s, and became involved in the Black Panther movement and so on.
And how extensive were the Panthers in London in that period of time? Did they have many chapters there, or were they?
The Black Panther movement were a separate organization from the Black Panther Party here in the United States. We took the name the Panther from the Panthers because we were inspired by what they were doing. We had chapters, we had three chapters in London, but our impact was national, and we worked with other independent black organizations up and down the country in places like Manchester and in Birmingham and so on.
How did you differ from the Panthers in the United States?
I think there were some ideological differences. There was never a nationalist element in the Black Panthers in England. We, for example, didn't carry guns because it's illegal in England to carry guns, but this is a gun culture in this country. There wasn't a great deal of difference in terms of the general outlook. We were both struggling against racial oppression. Maybe our methods were a bit different, but essentially we were fighting against the same kind of thing.
And how long did the movement last in organized form there?
The movement lasted about 4 or 5 years, and then a lot of the activists who came out of those organizations started other organizations and took the struggle to another level.
And what was the relationship between the movement and the general left in England? Was it a fraternal one? Was it a difficult one?
There was no close relationship with the left in England. I mean, the left were politically quite backward in England in those days. The Communist Party and especially the labor movement. The labor movement saw themselves as protecting the jobs of whites against these blacks who were coming to undercut them, sort of thing. And there were a few people joined the Communist Party and became completely alienated with the kind of Stalinist politics that they were propounding. So we had as a matter of fact, we radicalized the left in England. And at some stage, the Gay Liberation Front and the women's movement and them took heart from what blacks were doing. Well, hey, if these blacks can do this, you know, we can say something for ourselves too, and became active.
Lynn Kwesi Johnson, we played More Time before the break. Where did that come from?
Well, there are some. I've belonged to organizations over the years who've been advancing the ideas of the shorter working day and the shorter working week. Particularly a man called John LaRose, a political activist and publisher in London, and a trade unionist called Dave Feikirk. It's not pie in the sky stuff. We're living through a technological revolution comparable to the Industrial Revolution of the 18th century. And some people might say some people might only see one scenario, mass unemployment, robots taking over our jobs because of the increased productive capacity which the new technology affords us. But what I'm putting forward is the other alternative, full employment guaranteed, the shorter working day and the shorter working week. There is no immutable law of nature that says that human beings must work 40 hours per week, 5 days per week until you're 65 years old. And a lot of us are never able to realize what our real, true human potential is because we never have any time to find out. So I'm saying that this technological revolution that we're living under affords us the prospects of having more time for these things.
Well, since we did just play More Time, I thought we'd move a little to, and it fits perfectly into this new world order that we've got today.
Killers of Kigali must be sanitary workers. The butchers of Butari must be sanitary workers. The savages of Shatila must be sanitary workers. The beasts of Bosnia must be sanitary workers. Pram, pram, in the new world order. Like a dirty old bandage from the festering face of humanity, the old order unravel and reveal. Old scar just a broke out in a new sword. Primeval wound that time won't heal, and in the ancient currency of blood, tribal tyrants are set to world score. The killers of Kigali must be sanitary workers. The butchers of Butari must be sanitary workers. The savages of Shatila must be sanitary workers. The beasts of Bosnia must be sanitary workers. Pram, pram, in the new world order. And it's the same old Cain and Abel syndrome, far more ancient than the fall of Rome. But in the new world order of atrocity, is a brand new language of barbarity. Mass murder normalized, pogrom rationalized, genocide sanitized, and the ancient clan sin. No name ethnic cleansing.
New word, how Lytton Kwesi Johnson.
The savages of Shatila must be sanitary workers. The beasts of Bosnia must be sanitary workers. Pram, pram, in the new word order.
Talk a little more about the new word order.
That was my way of commenting on a lot of the atrocities which are taking place in the world today. And it seems to me that the mass media, sometimes guilty of using language in a most insidious kind of a way, by talking about these atrocities with the term ethnic cleansing, as though it was some kind of ethnic mess that needed to be cleaned up, you know. And I find this use of language very, very dangerous. And it seems to... It's the use of language in a way that makes these crimes against humanity seem like everyday natural occurrences. And that's the point I was trying to make there.
Talking about crimes against humanity, you also deal a lot with the issue of police brutality.
Police brutality has been an ongoing issue in terms of the struggle of black people in England. During the last 30 years, we've made a lot of progress. We fought some struggles and won some battles. We have a black middle class emerging. We are no longer as marginalized as we used to be. We
About have, what percent of the population in England now is black?
Gosh, you got me there, man. I would imagine not, it'd be less than 5%. Mm-hmm. So yes, I'm saying we made some progress, but some things just haven't changed at all. And one of those things is the issue of the relationship between blacks and the police. Racism is institutionalized in the police force, and successive police commissioners and home secretaries have done absolutely nothing about it. It's
but
ingrained.
But the police, they're not armed, right? So that there's not the problem of people being shot to death.
Increasingly, they're using arms when they come to raid any part of the black community. They come with body armor and they come with guns, you know.
And how, again, many people have been killed? How many?
At least 50 black people have died in police custody during the last 15 years. And, you know, something needs to be done about it, and nobody isn't doing anything about it.
Linton Kwesi Johnson, License to Kill.
Sometimes I think my co-worker crazy. The way Christine would have gone and jokey-jokey. Then the next time now, I know nonsense dance. The way she wind down the place, last Christmas dance. The way she loved to talk about conspiracy. Me and Christine in the canteen a talk about the deck of black people in a custody. How not a cat make me yo or a damn dog bark. How nobody high up in a society can offer explanation nor remedy. When Christine it up her brow like say a row, she a go row. Screw up her face like say a trace, she a go trace. Hear her now. You think I just MI5 and James Bond and police and soldier over North Island one. When it come to black people, Winston, some police in England got license for kill. Well, nothing Christine said surprised me still. But hear me now. What you mean, Christine? I will tell you that. I must be one idiot. You can't prove that. I will tell me if you go say that. Christine kissed her teeth, then she cut me with her eye and she said, you want proof? You can't have skin on my curbing about him asphyxiation. And you can't have Strike Garden about her suffocation. You can't ask Colin Roach if him really shoot himself. And you can't ask Vincent Graham if he's him stab himself. But you can ask the commissioner about the license to kill. Ask Sir Paul Condon about the license to kill. You can't ask the Douglas them about the new style baton. And you can't ask Tony Hassan about him dead by neglect. You can't ask Marlon Downs if him have any regret. And you can't ask El Gamal about the mystery I'm dead.
That's License for Kill. Linton Kwesi Johnson, and it's on his CD, More Time. Linton Kwesi Johnson in our studio. Powerful music, poetry, dub poetry. For some, it may be a new word. Talk a little about the origins of dub poetry.
I always get into a little bit of difficulty with this dub poetry thing, really, because I don't call myself a dub poetry. I mean, I'm quite happy to live with the term. In fact, I have no choice but to live with the term. But I use the term dub. I coined the term dub lyricism and talked about the poetry of some of the reggae DJs. I was trying to use it to describe the art, to coin a term to describe the art of the reggae DJs. Consequently, my fellow poet, Jamaican poet Okwo Nura, who went to the Jamaica School of Drama with a group of other poets, there was a whole new movement of oral poetry developed in the school there, and they called it dub poetry because they felt it was, oral poetry mixed with reggae music or with any form of music, and what one was doing was dubbing the voice onto the music sort of thing. But that's Oku's concept, not mine.
You've been very influenced by many Caribbean intellectuals, both who come to England and who are there. In fact, you knew C.L.R. James.
Mm-hmm.
You came to know him in England.
Yes, C.L.R. James lived with us in the upstairs of the offices of the Race Today Collective.
It was called the Race Today Collective.
Race Today Collective is a political organization. Used to publish a newspaper. James was our ideologue. We followed his ideas. He died just before the collapse of the Berlin Wall, and we were very unhappy that he wasn't alive to see it because he predicted it. He wrote a very important book called Notes on the Dialectics, where he used Hegelian philosophy to show that Stalin and them had got it wrong in the Soviet Union. He was a great man and wrote a very important book called Beyond the Boundary about growing up in the West Indies and cricket, and also The Black Jacobins about the history of the Haitian Revolution, which established the first independent black republic in the West. Great man.
I'm interested in terms of the other colonial people of England, the Irish, and what the relationship has been between the Irish and their struggle and blacks in England. Has it been difficult? Has there been some sense of solidarity there at all?
Mm-hmm. Most definitely. I mean, in the early days, they used to have signs in the windows, no blacks, no dogs, no Irish, no blacks, no Irish, no dogs, and so on. And the Irish were the niggers before we arrived. And there's quite a lot of socialization between Irish workers and black workers on building sites and so on. And the Republican movement, a lot of black people could identify with the Republican movement, having come out of colonial societies ourselves, knowing what it is to be dominated by somebody else and to be forced to listen, to learn their language and their history and all the rest of it. And when I was a member of the Race Today Collective, our organizations had direct solidarity with the Republican movement. We invited Jerry Adams over to speak to us. We used to get their newspaper every week, and they used to get ours. And we even published some of the short stories of Bobby Sands, the IRA hunger striker who died in prison.
Well, we're going to go out today with Making History, one of the songs that have made you very well known, which is also about another group, of, you could put blacks in quotes, and that's Asians in England, if that's fair to say.
It's about the various insurrections that took place during the 80s in England, involving both blacks and the Asian community together in solidarity.
Linton Kwesi Johnson, we want to thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Linton Kwesi Johnson. One of his CDs is More Time. His latest, actually, is not published yet here in the United States, though he does have his own record label. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can order it by calling the Pacific Archives, 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Hisu Ku and Jeremy Scahill. Special thanks to Samori Marksman and Dred Scott Keyes. Our executive producer is Julie Drizin. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! From the studios of WBAI in New York, also Joe Gill in Washington, our engineer.
Your race is politics. Eh? Well, down in Bristol, they had no pistol. But them kids, your Babylon away. Man, you should have seen your Babylon how them really run away. You should have seen your Babylon then. Pick up that gear. Pick up that gear.